Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture.
Today's episode, Violet Murder.
Yes, we'd probably better do some words, eh?
We probably should do some words. Before we do some words, we have a new Patreon supporter in the person of Fish Expert Andy from the other episode.
I am so delighted. I feel like people like Fish Expert Andy need to be brought into our fold.
Absolutely. And Fish Expert Andy has definitely been has jumped into the fold with both feet, as it were now. So
awesome.
So thank you very much, Andy. Your support is appreciated. We're glad we could indulge your curiosity by figuring out your frankly mystifying example of sport, which neither of us had ever heard before, but was cool.
It was really cool. Yeah, great. Thank you. We love the Patreon peeps.
They're great. Patreon.com/lexitecture for those who are wondering. # always be plugging. I have a wee little word.
I have a word that I just kept finding out more and more and more things about. So I can go first. You can go first. I really don't mind.
I'll go first because I'm happy with how relatively short and truncated and short and sweet my thing is. But then after you finish your long, awesome dive, I will probably feel less confident in the worth of my short little entry this week. So how about I go first and we'll build up. I'll be the amuse-bouche.
That phrase really, really amuses me. It amuses my mind as well as my bouche.
It's so good.
Yeah. And you know, the first time I had an amuse-bouche, I was in quite a posh restaurant on the Isle of... Not a posh restaurant, but a very, very good restaurant on the Isle of Skye. And I genuinely didn't know what was going on because, you know, I was not brought up in fine restaurants. And they were like, this is just a nice little thing for you to try. And I was like, well, this is awesome.
that's pretty amazing.
Does this happen all the time?
Mission accomplished. I was listening to an episode of Off Menu.
Oh, yeah.
James A. Castor and Ed Gamble, and they had Josh Gondelman on, who is amazing if you've never...
I don't think I have ever heard of Josh Gondelman. Him.
Oh, man. He's a semi-regular guest on Alice Fraser's various, either The Gargle or Last Post or whatever. And his thing on Off Menu was awesome. And they also got into a whole thing about, like, coming up with various tangents and variations on the theme of amuse-bouche. So they came up and James A. Castor, like, the amuse-bouche today is just a pizza covered in raw fish. And they're like, that really sounds more like a confuse-bouche. Or possibly even a refuse-bouche. And it was like just the running thing through the whole show, and it was really awesome. It was great. Now, how's that for a tangent? Anyway, so...
Go forth, amuse.
I will go forth and amuse, hopefully, all of your collective bouches and all the other stuff.
I just fell into a little Goodfellas loop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's understandable. These things happen. So, I have long heard people wondering and pondering about where orange comes from, whether it was first a color or a fruit first.
Yes.
That whole thing, like... And I've heard that a lot, and it's one of those, I think it's a relatively common kind of like quasi-philosophical, ooh, there's a head scratcher that back in the day when it was literally just you had to leave a conversation not knowing the answer to something.
Yeah, remember that.
Was one of those things that people just sort of threw out there. My word isn't orange, but it's similar to that in that it could easily be the focus of the same question. But for some reason, until I looked it up sort of by accident, it had never occurred to me to ask the question of whether or not violets are called that because they're violet, or whether a violet thing is called that because it resembles a violet, flower.
This is already wonderful, and I'll tell you why. I have a really, there's a special place in my heart for the name violet, and it's because just thinking that once upon a time this story might have got me sacked, but it's fine because I don't work.
I like it already.
I don't work for the NHS anymore. So the National Health Service employed me in my youth. I had gone to school and gone to university and graduated, and I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life, and I needed some cash. And there was a large teaching hospital just up the road, and I applied for a job there doing admin. And one of the many jobs that I had to do as, you know, kind of admin grunt was filing. And filing took me a lot into the main medical records store.
Right.
And at that time, I hope it's not still the same, but I really couldn't tell you. That meant paper records, just grey folders of paper records. And they were stored by date and then by alphabetically. So you would look up the person's date of birth first, and then obviously there would be many, many people with the same date of birth, and you would go through the alphabet to find them on the shelf. And one day I found the notes, completely by accident, I found the notes of a woman whose name was Violet Armour.
Oh,
and I laughed for about a week. And it was one of these things where I'm like, this is a little bit funny. Like, it is not wildly funny. It's probably not nearly as funny as I am currently giving it credit for and laughing my ass off about. But I just, it just really, really amused me to think of this little purple knight.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So yes, Violet, tell me more.
So I don't think it's a spoiler because I'm about to say the actual answer, but the answer is the flower came first, sort of, mostly, I think.
I was almost certain that you were going to say the answer is there's no answer, nobody knows. So this is more specific than I was expecting. Good work.
So, it's also one of those. So recently, as an aside, I did a piece for Grammar Girl for the podcast and for the website on the difference between chord and chord. Chord
with a
CH as a musical chord, or chord without an H as in a piece of rope or string or electrical cord or something. And that was one of those things where it's like people kind of get them confused. They get them confused in the phrase to strike a chord.
Yes.
Are you striking a rope? Are you striking a musical set of harmonious notes or whatever else? And so that was my assignment, was to look into that. And so I looked into it, assuming that when I looked up the etymology, there would be somewhere in the mists of time that it would be like, oh, perfect. There's the thing you can use to remember the difference or something. There's the answer. There's where they became conflated or whatever. And I'm not going to go into it because I went into it on there, and you can check it out on the Grammar Girl website. But the short answer is they've always been confused. They've always been confusing, and they've always been hideously intertwined, and it's annoying to look into.
Tangled. Yeah, I mean, the thing about the mists of time is they're pretty damn misty.
They sure are. And this is, it reminded me of that a little bit. So the earliest OED entry for the word violet as the name of a specific flower was in 1330.
Okay.
The earliest entry as a descriptor of a color, and they have two very similar, like, it's one of those things where the OED has them as two separate senses, but you kind of go, are they though? Like, you know, one sense is, I think it was like, and they're so similar that it actually has a little note underneath the first one that says, this is often almost similar, almost exactly the same as the one below it.
Yeah, sure.
But it was like, one was like the color of the flower, and one was like the same color as the flower or something like that. Like, it wasn't that, but it was that level of, now you're being a little bit silly. But so, but the earliest descriptor for something else was either 1380 or around 1400, depending on which of those two very similar senses you're looking at. So
okay.
50 to 70 years later. So not a huge span of time.
I love how when I look at things like history and etymology, my scale of time just completely mashed, because I mean, I intellectually, I know that between 1300 and 1400 was 100 years. But also, since it's a period of time I'm often looking at from an etymological perspective, you're like, ah, oh, that's nothing. You know, first citation was in 1310 and the second was in 1340. First usage was in 1310, second was 1340. They were probably both being used at the same time. You know, there's no way to split those hairs. And then you're like, wait a minute, dude, that's 30 years. That's like nearly as long as you've been alive. No, yeah. More
well,
than...
Well, between 1330 and 1400 was probably three generations of people.
Yeah, I've forgotten how old I am, incidentally, just while I'm saying that. It's like, I had a really confusing moment where I was like, wait, have I been... Yes, I... What? Did that make sense?
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything. It's... So, yeah, so it's probable that it, in English, was first used as a flower.
Okay.
But again, hard to tell.
Yeah, sure.
Nothing super conclusive. It comes from French... which is why it shows up in the 1300s, like with a lot of, in that era of Norman influence. And it comes from the French violette, either with one T or two, which is a diminutive of viol.
Oh.
So they add the et as in like
it seems so obvious like that. That, of course, et is diminutive in French, but it had never occurred to me before. Yeah.
And viol comes from Latin, viola, Viola, whatever you want to do with the V, which means get ready to be super helped, either the flower or something the color of the flower.
I was thinking of the viols and the trumpets of sort of, you know, early musical heritage, but I presume that those words are unrelated.
So as part of this, I also had tabs open for viola,
so many tabs,
the instrument,
yes,
and violin, and also violence, and violate, and none of them are related. So
okay, that's very interesting.
Yeah, so they're all, those are all different, but we're still at a point where in Latin it still either meant the flower or something the color of the flower, which doesn't leave us any further ahead. So we go back to Greek. Now in university I took exactly one midterm worth of ancient Greek. I was in my first year of university. I was doing an English degree, but I was heavily weighing my schedule in terms of classics because that was what was available and I found them interesting. So I was taking Latin and Greek in the same semester, and Greek was at 8:30 in the morning on a Friday. And that's not a great time for me to try to learn ancient Greek now.
I mean,
but
dude, personally, as a student, I would have gone, oh, Greek sounds interesting. Oh, wait, it's at 8:30 on a Friday. Greek and I are not destined to be together.
Not meant to be. Well, and fate has a way of winning those kind of things. So I arrived at my midterm. I literally received the midterm exam paper. I looked at it. I flipped through it. I literally wrote, I'm sorry at the top. I handed it into the teacher and I walked out 10 minutes after the exam started and I walked directly to the registrar's office and dropped the course. So... So
the
that's my
end.
Experience. Yeah, that's my academic career in ancient, in classical ancient Greek was that. So it, as a surprise, it will come as a surprise to no one that I do not know how to pronounce this word necessarily. And when I come across a transliteration of a Greek word that I don't know how to pronounce, I often just sort of default to saying, like just naming the letters in a row.
Okay.
So like this word is spelled I-O-E-I-D-E-S. And I would literally just be like, oh, it's a Greek word. I-O-E-I-D-E-S. And I would just name the word. Like I would just mash the letters together and name them all at once.
I think I didn't know that that's what I was doing, but I think you've just beautifully described what I do when I try to pronounce Greek words.
Yeah, it's totally, it didn't occur to me until I got to this. And I was like, maybe I'll spell it out loud. And then I spelled it out loud and I went, I'm just doing the same thing, but slower.
Yes.
It's that, weird.
I think that's probably... valid? I don't know. Yeah.
So this Greek word, Edom Online says, means the color of violets, which is still not how violet colored, but it comes from a Greek root, ion, which means, drumroll please, the dark blue flower. So I think we have cracked it, that the flower does in fact come first, because the Greek root is... as far as I can see, specifically refers to the flower. But you have to go back to ancient Greek to get there.
And I have Googled it while I was talking to you.
Okay.
And maybe you're about to talk about this. I don't know. But when you were talking about Io,
this works too. Yeah.
Sorry. I thought, like Iolanthe.
Oh, I wasn't going to say that because
talk about Iolanthe, which is interesting. I don't know. Iolanthe is, technically speaking, it is a feminine given name, Wikipedia says. I've never met an Iolanthe in real life, but there is an opera by Arthur Sullivan called Iolanthe, and I'm aware that it is a name. And it occurred to me, as you were talking, that Io, this V-O-I-O thing, sounded a bit like Iolanthe. And then I thought, wait a minute, anthe means flower. And the name Iolanthe, derived from Koine Greek, means violet flower.
There you go.
So there we go, yeah.
So we still don't necessarily have an answer, which is...
Damn it.
So it makes sense to me that the thing would come first.
Yeah.
Because colors, like... Colors, to me, I think are a little bit like smells. Like as far as I can see, I'm sure I stand to be corrected because I'm sure there's going to be someone who's like, no, we actually do have very concrete ways of describing things. But to me, the only real way to talk about either colors or smells, less so taste for some reason, is by analogy. Like, what does this smell like? Oh, it smells like this other thing that you've probably smelled.
This is exactly how I teach imagery. To kids, I ask them if they've ever eaten dog, because of course I have, and most of them haven't.
Yeah.
And I say that in order to, if I wanted to describe dog to you, you've got no frame of reference for what that would taste like, so I have to use like or as.
Yes.
I could say it was as tender as, or as fatty as, or it tasted like, and that's why imagery exists, because you know, you start off with comparison and then you get into, well, lies. That's my teaching stick for similes and metaphors.
Yeah. And we have words for sort of the the concepts involved in taste. So you can talk about something in terms of its sweetness, bitterness, saltiness, whatever. I find smells don't have the same thing. And I don't think colors can have the same
No, you're right. There are words that kind of try to get at that. Like I'm thinking about like bright and bold or pastel or... but it's very hard before you have to use other colours.
Yeah, yeah. Or a concrete item.
Yeah.
It's coloured like...
Thing.
That's the shade of, you know, the shade of pine trees that are covered in snow, but it's in the golden hour just at sunset. That shade of green. Or, you know, like that kind of thing, which I guess, as I'm thinking about it now, makes sense because we only, like, color is only light reflected off of a certain thing. So, like, it sort of only exists in this sort of relative analogous way, almost. Am I talking garbage?
No.
Or does that make sense?
I was thinking it's like you were saying about the sort of pseudo-philosophical thing about orange. There's that similar kind of who knows if what we see as blue is the same color.
Yeah.
We just
have a
shared
king of all 13-year-old philosopher questions.
Yeah. Well, we have a shared understanding that those things are that color that we call this thing. But whether I mean, human experience is so incredibly subjective that there's no way for anyone to actually tell the answer to that. You know, you can't figure that out.
And so we have to rely on it's the color of this.
Yeah.
And so I suppose it shouldn't, having gone through all of that just now, I suppose it shouldn't necessarily be a surprise that both orange and violet, at least orange definitely, violet seems to be in the same camp where it started as the thing that has that color and everyone points to that and be like, that's this. And then you say, oh, that's the same color as this. And it becomes like the byword for that particular color and then just becomes the name of the color. Interestingly, as a final aside, that Io, and this is where I thought you might be going.
Properly interrupted you.
No, it's fine. Because this is where I thought you might be going when you said it triggered something and you Googled it. The Io is also where we get iodine. the word iodine.
Of course.
And it's because the French chemist who first named it noticed that when you heat it up, it emits a purplish vapor.
Yes.
And so he called it iodine after that io, the flower, the Greek word for that, for the violet. So that's why it's iodine. So
That's lovely.
Iodine is also, so iodine and violet. So weirdly, iodine and violets are related, but violets and violas are not. Nor are violets and violins. So, you know, take of that what you will. I don't know if there's anything to take of that. I think it's just a thing. But I thought it was interesting. And I needed something to wrap the segment. So there we go.
That's it. That's super cool. I like that a lot. I actually had a similar experience to today when I was researching the word that I'm going to talk about. I got there by a fairly torturous route, as usual. But I did one of those, like, head thunk, of course, Amy, moments.
right.
Having wondered, hey, I wonder if this is related to that. And then when I looked up that, I was like, no, of course not, you fool. And here's why. So, I'll stop being vague and actually tell you what I'm talking about.
Okay,
the word that I'm the word that I'm looking at, you're going to enjoy this word already just because it's, I've almost definitely told you this before, but there used to be a TV show on in the 80s in Scotland. It starred an actor called Mark McManus. It was a police procedural called Taggart. And
okay.
The kind of stereotype of Taggart, the thing that sort of sticks in the cultural memory, is that this detective, Taggart, would appear and say, "There's been a murder." And people who enjoy Scottish accents really enjoy the phrase, "There's been a murder."
Yeah, so, obviously.
Yeah, my sister had an Irish boyfriend when she was at university, and his brother used to always say, "Go and say there's been a murder." And so I decided to have a look at the word murder. I thought it was a little bit interesting, and of course, good fun to say, and I knew it would make you giggle. So from violent violence on to murderous thoughts and murderous ways.
Nice.
And I discovered that well, it's old, which isn't hugely surprising because, you know,
right.
Human beings are sort of terrible. And
yeah, and have been for some time now.
Yeah, yeah. Bashing in people's heads and generally causing them harm. It's as old as time. Tale as old as time, but without a singing teapot. And if you go to the OED, it's, you know, this pattern that we've seen and we often comment on. The older entry refers to the nim, but very, very close on its heels with that same kind of, it's impossible to really decide. I often wonder, actually, if it's just a kind of a convention within the OED that they put the name first and they kind of look for it in older places. I don't know. That's another question for another day. But murder is defined as the action or an act of killing. And the first citation that the OED has is from Beowulf. So Old English,
wow.
And then there's actually a second Old English citation from the Blickling Homilies. And one of the things I like greatly about words that are as old as this is that you come across the wonderful Old English letters that have fallen out of usage.
Yes.
And you know me, I would really love to use ashes and thorns and eths and yogs and all that stuff because I'm a massive geek. But murder, with the hard D as we say it, is often written in these Old English and very early citations with either an eth, which is the letter that looks like an O with a tail heading towards the top of the letter and a little cross on the end.
Yeah.
And is pronounced, it's actually, they're two different letters, although they kind of describe the same sound. It's the, as in words like this, that, or the.
Right.
Whereas thorn, which looks like a P with a kind of an extended serif or a line with a bubble on it that's been rotated 90 degrees, is also a th sound, but thorn is words like thing or thought.
It's the voiced versus unvoiced,
that's
right?
That's right, yeah. That's how it's differentiated. So your vocal cords don't vibrate when saying thing or thought, but they do when you say this, that, or the.
Yeah. Can I also just say that Ashes and Thorns would be a great name for an incredibly secretly, incredibly nerdy metal band?
Dude, don't you know anything about metal? All metalheads are incredibly nerdy.
That's true.
That's why metal is such an amazing, fantastic scene.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of Ashes and Thorns and Eths kicking around. So the Beowulf citation has it as Morthrys, and the Blickling Homilies has it as Morthor. And then we get the first dated one, which is circa 1175. And again, Murthur is what's going on.
Right.
And we see this is quite a common pattern of TH becoming the hard D. There's precedent for this in other places and with other words. But there's an interesting little quirk about the definition for the word murder. And the OED talks about it, as does Etym Online. So here's what the OED has to say about it. In Old English, the word could be applied to any homicide that was strongly reprobated. It's therefore sometimes difficult, especially in early use, to distinguish clearly between this sense and sense A1C, which obviously comes later on in the entry. More strictly, however, it denoted secret murder, which in Germanic antiquity was alone regarded as a crime in the modern sense, open homicide being considered a private wrong calling for blood revenge or compensation. And Etym Online makes the same distinction, saying that there was an Old Norse custom distinguished morth, secret slaughter, from vig, which meant slaying. In other words, it was only bad if you did it in secret.
Can we all just agree again that the past was a terrible place to be?
Yeah, I think it gives you such a... It's one of these really lovely examples of where language gives you a massive insight into culture and also makes you really glad that you don't live there.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, well, your deaths, yeah, the killings, they happen all the time, but make sure everyone can see, dude. Otherwise, yeah, murder, it's bad.
Yeah, murder in broad daylight. Oh, well, all right then.
And I also totally love the notion that, like, killing someone vig-wise, you could be like, oh, dude, come on, you need to pay me for that killing. I need some sheep or some gold or something, you know.
Something.
Or you could have revenge also, blood revenge or compensation. Those things are very much like, oh, I killed your brother. Well, here's some cash. You know. Again, a beautiful little insight into why I'm glad I'm not an Old Norse human. Yeah. So it continues in the OED. Even under Edward I, Britain explains the Anglo-Norman murdre only as felonious homicide in which both the perpetrator and the victim are not identified. Now, it goes on this note. It talks about the kind of legal definition of murder and how even that has interesting variances. So, for example, it's essential to the legal definition of murder that the perpetrator be of sound mind, and in England, although not in Scotland, that death should ensue within a year and a day after the act presumed to have caused it.
Oh.
Which is interesting, isn't it? And it really made me wonder. So if you bash someone over the head, in the times where murder only counted if it was in private, I'm going to guess that the medical care wasn't awesome, and most people who sustained injuries bad enough, they'd probably died fairly quickly. But these days, I think the notion that a year and a day passing between the kind of cause of the injury and death, it's not out of the realms of possibility that could happen. But because of that very odd kind of almost like a statute of limitation there in English law, you could happily, you know, inflict an act of violence on a person, but as long as they don't die for a year and a day, it doesn't matter, kind of thing. You know, it's not really a murder. It's not really a killing.
Yeah.
In British law, no degrees of guilt are recognised in murder. US law distinguishes murder in the first degree and murder in the second degree. So that, of course, has to do with intent. And so murder in the second degree is intentional but unpremeditated. And in the first degree, it's in the course of a crime and without mitigating circumstances. So yeah, I had no idea that murder was so complicated. I kind of thought it was going to be a short, sharp, pretty simple kind of the action or an act of killing. But the OED does point out that actually it's much more kind of nuanced than that. So we have various other senses, terrible slaughter, massacre, loss of life, or an instance of this, which is listed here as obsolete. I don't know that that's technically true. Oh, perhaps the kind of shade of meaning is something that I'm kind of missing out on. And that one C, the action of killing or causing destruction of life, regarded as wicked and morally reprehensible, irrespective of its legality, which is interesting.
Right, yeah.
And then we have the personification of murder, which comes in about 1569 is the first citation. We see it in Shakespeare and Titus Andronicus. Lo, by thy side where rape and murder stands, now give that assurance that thou art revenge.
Right.
So, yeah, interesting. And then we get into murder being used as a word to describe wickedness or sin. This is an obsolete usage that's given in the OED. We have torment, punishment, severe injury or damage, another obsolete sense, used in Old English, and the last citation that they have is 1465. And murdrum, which I enjoyed.
Yeah.
From about 1210 to about 1823. This is a word that we kind of see in usage. And also it's a figurative or a hyperbolic use of, you know, terrible harm or destruction or terrible sort of occurrence that doesn't necessarily lead to death, but something extremely unpleasant or difficult to deal with. And it's interesting because that's a usage that I'm very familiar with. I don't know if it's particularly a Scots thing, if it's just peculiar to my kind of family, but my mother, for example, would often say, oh, it was murder. Like I went to a prize given and the speeches went on for 5 hours. Man, it was murder.
Yeah, so I've definitely heard that.
Yeah, so I as I say, I find that very, very familiar. There's an interesting one which I didn't know before I started researching this, that in 1920s American slang, murder meant something or someone excellent or marvelous. I suppose in the same way that like bad and wicked used sort of later on. Well, I think of those as 80s slang words. They're probably older than that. When I think about it, but first citation for that is 1927 and the last is 1986, where JCRD said the new Stones album is pure murder.
That's cool.
There are a lot more compound words than I was expecting, and also some really lovely variations. So we have murther, which is closer to that Germanic th eth or thorn usage. And that's an obsolete Scottish in later use. And a murther was a murderer or an assassin. So and another kind of noun form. And that lovely word murdrum, which was from the 11th to the 15th century, a fine imposed by the crown on a manor or hundred in which a murder had been committed. So again, this notion of cash for death kind of coming in. Etymologically speaking, because I haven't actually mentioned that yet. There are tons and tons, you know, hugely Germanic. There are lots and lots of Proto-Germanic, Old Saxon, Old Frisian variations that have that sense of certainly M-O or M-U. We have morth, murt, murd. And it ultimately is traced back to a pie root, mer, M-E-R. Which is given as, the meaning of which is given as, to rub away or to harm.
Oh,
now, there is a pie root that seems, the meaning seems to be to die, and then all words referring to death and all the kind of death stuff is traced back to this. But also this meaning of to rub away or to harm, I think is very interesting.
Yeah.
So here are some of the cognates for that. Amaranth, ambrosia, immortize, Amritsar, the place, immortal, manticore, marasmus, mare, as in nightmare, a night goblin on an incubus, morbid, mordacious, mordant, moribund, so all these M-O-R words, morsel, mort, which is defined as the note sounded on a horn at the death of the quarry, very, very bleak, mortal and mortality, mortar, mortgage, mortify, mortmy, mortuary, murder, murrain, nightmare, postmortem, and remorse. Really,
oh, remorse
really
interesting.
So at this point, I thought, oh, does that mean that a mermaid has something to do with violence or death?
Oh.
And I, you know, I found myself wondering, because a lot of the time when you're thinking about kind of mythical creatures, fairies, you know, things that are often in a modern context painted as whimsical and beautiful, you know, as we find with Nightmare, often there are really, really grim, both in terms of fairy tales and in terms of the adjective. They're often kind of grim early stories of these things. So I looked up mermaid and discovered, of course, the mer part of mermaid means sea.
Yeah, right.
As in la mer in French. So, yeah, I had that forehead slap, blah, of course, moment with that particular one. Yeah, so lots of interesting threads within the pie root. We've got Sanskrit words that mean crushes or bruises. We have killing and dying and death, also the sense of mortality. We have it in Old Persian as a word that simply means man. And then Marnu in Hittite, which means to make disappear, which is very kind of mafia euphemistic. Quite enjoyed that. Lots and lots of dying things here. Dying roots, Old Church Slavonic. Woo! We have OCS. Mreti, to die. And words meaning to die or meaning death. But an interesting little discovery that both this th becomes a d, as happens, you know, you see it in other words and other etymologies. Goose was a word given as an example in tooth, which both had roots which had that kind of sound change going on. And the verb follows very quickly on from that. The first citation given is 1175. Again, she says, follows on quickly. So it was probably only like 200 to 300 years before that first citation.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that the notion that the act of the thing followed on pretty quickly after the thing is kind of given life, given a word. Yeah. There are also, finally, you know that this wonderful list that you get down the side of the OED page when you look up a definition, we have where it falls in the alphabetical list.
Right.
And here are some of the ones that are next to murder. And it's as though someone just thought, I like the sound of this. I'm going to just attach absolutely everything to it I can possibly think. So we have murder noun 2, murder verb, murderabilia.
Ooh.
As in, you know, like memorabilia, but murderabilia.
Yeah.
Murderable. We all know people like that.
Right, yeah.
And murderably. Then the very excellent murderation.
Oh,
I think I would. I like that. Oh, there's an awful lot of murderation going on out here. I like that. We have murder ball, of course, and murderdom. Then murdered adjective, and probably my favourite, murdery.
Oh, that's nice.
So it's right there in the OED, and a murdery is of course a murder victim, a person who is murdered, and it's first cited by H. Smith in 1846. Thus we sat, grim and silent, cold and raw, two destined murderers and one murdery.
Oh, that's cool. I like that.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
All sorts Very of cool. murder.
All sorts of murder. It's interesting, like I don't know where I never know where I'm going with any of this stuff, but the thing that I'm thinking about is just, this is one of those words that for some reason has thrown into helpful relief just the concept of Proto-Indo-European as a language. Like the way we kind of, you and I, approach it is we go back and we find the pie root and we just be like, this is the pie root.
Yeah,
but
sure.
This is a good example of why people think that the pie root exists, is because you have Murther or Murther or whatever in the Germanic side, which ostensibly, unless you go that far back, has no real relation to Latin, but the words are obviously similar to the words where you get mortuary and morgue and, like, you know, immortal, those Latin words.
Sure.
And it's so like, oh, that's how it got
mori.
It's like, that's,
yeah,
these are the building blocks of the reverse engineering that ends up with the concept of Proto-Indo-European and why people hypothesize and
it is,
stuff. So it's kind
it
of a cool
just,
example of that.
It's one of these things. It's like how you can't think too hard about how an airplane flies when you're taking a flight, because your brain gets scrambled and the fear kicks in. But when you start to actually consider the sheer number of hours that and research and scholarship that have gone into even the hypothesis that Proto-Indo-European exists.
Yeah.
You know, it's staggering. It's absolutely staggering. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. We kind of use it as a, well, this is the last answer we can find, so we'll tell you about it. But when you look at that, just the massive flinging of language across continents that, you know, from Sanskrit to Greek to Latin to all of these Germanic languages, all of these, you know, Slavonic and even Russian has morit to exterminate. Yeah, it's a really... on all of these places, of course, have death. So
the notion famously,
that
yeah.
The notion that the word would travel, I suppose, isn't hugely difficult to take on.
Yeah, very cool.
Violet Murder.
Yeah, it was the only
people are going to think that's a misprint.
Question. Was yeah, exactly. It's like, is this a typo? Violet Murder or a Murder Violet? I don't know.
Murder Violet sounds like the kind of band I would have gone to see when I was about 19.
Yeah.
Hoping that they had a female bassist.
Oh, Murder Violet definitely had a female bass player.
Yeah, I do. I feel like there's a female bassist in Murder Violet.
100%. Cool. Murder Violet. They opened for Ashes and Thorns once, didn't they?
Ashes and Thorns. I'd totally go and see Ashes and Thorns. Actually, I kind of feel like Mark Sundaram could easily be the guitarist in a band called Ashes and Thorns.
Well, now it has to happen.
It really does. There's a Scottish there's a group of Scottish crime writers who get together and play five-a-side football.
Oh, okay.
So if that can be a thing. Yeah. What's his name? I was about to say Ian Banks, not Ian Banks. Ian Rankin and Chris Brookmeyer. And there's a lot that there are more writers. There's not just these two guys, but they're both
right.
Famously football fans, and I've heard them on, you know, sort of sporting shows and things like that talking about this. But yeah, the kind of Murder 11, well, not if it's five asides. If that can exist, then surely a philological metal band called Ashes and Thorns is...
I think it's going to have to happen.
I can see their tour poster, you know?
Yeah. I think if sound education becomes a thing, we're just going to have to find a bar in Boston that has like a full stage setup, and we're just going to go and play like a couple tunes as Ashes and Thorns.
Yeah.
We just need to find a bass player or a guitar player to do whatever Mark isn't doing at the time, and then we'll be good to go. Be perfect.
I'm absolutely. I could sell the merch at an Ashes and Thorns gigs. Easy.
Absolutely. Murder Violet can open. Awesome.
And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture. To get in touch with us about something you heard in this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.